Welcome to WhiskeyCast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 436 for August 3rd, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
My son Henry, he's 10. And I said, see that cask there, son, that 225-litre cask? Yes, Dad, I can see that cask. And I said to him, well, when that cask is ready, I said, you can bottle that and you're to take it down to the Salamanca markets in Hobart and sell that whiskey down there at the market stall. I said, that money is able to put you through your university education and buy your car or whatever.
Keith Batt bought the Nant Estate in Tasmania 9 years ago. Never dreamed of making whiskey there at first, but now his family's Nant Distillery is celebrating its 5th anniversary this year. He's opening up Nant whiskey bars around Australia as well, and there might just be one near you in the future, in Europe or North America. More with Keith Batt later on WhiskeyCast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and in the What I'm Tasting This Week department, my tasting notes for the new Stagg Junior Bourbon. That's all coming up on this week's WhiskeyCast.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Diageo reported its financials for the fiscal year ending June 30th this week, and the world's largest whiskey maker saw its profits increase by 8% globally. Overall sales grew by 5%, but price increases for Johnnie Walker and most other Diageo brands helped pump up profits. Johnnie Walker sales broke the 20 million case threshold for the first time, while single malt sales worldwide rose by 17%. North America, Latin America, and the Caribbean were the company's strongest markets, while the European economy remained a soft spot. Now, I just referred to Diageo as the world's largest whiskey maker, and new CEO Ivan Menezes wants to make the company even bigger. He told the Wall Street Journal after the earnings release this week that Diageo has the capacity to absorb any acquisition it wants to pursue, and when he was asked specifically about Beam, he said, quote, "We look at everything." Wall Street analysts have been looking for someone to make a run at buying Beam ever since it became a standalone spirits company 2 years ago. But CEO Matt Shattuck has consistently said Beam plans to remain independent. Beam executives did not comment on the journal's report. Now, bourbon is the one weak spot in the Diageo portfolio, with Bullet Bourbon being its one entry in the category. While Diageo has often been mentioned as a potential suitor for Beam, there are some barriers that could make it tough to pull off. My story on WhiskeyCast.com this week explains some of those barriers, and why last week's story on a settlement with air quality regulators in Louisville could clear the way for a decision soon on the future of the old Stitzel Weller distillery. Meanwhile, Beam announced its own expansion plans on Thursday. The company wants to build a new 600,000-square-foot distribution center near its bottling plant in Frankfort, Kentucky. Beam is looking for a global logistics company to own and run the center, which would hold stockpiles of whiskey and other Beam products for shipment to distributors around the world. The Frankfort bottling plant handles about 55% of Beam's production in Kentucky, along with bottling Canadian Club and other Beam products. The new distribution center is expected to open in 2015. One more business note. Capital Brands, which bottled Jailer's Tennessee Whiskey, Breakout Rye, and Forbidden Secret Whiskey Cream Liqueur, has reportedly ceased operations. Whiskey writer Fred Minnick first reported the story on his blog Thursday, citing Dave Shurick, the company's lead ambassador and master distiller for its planned Tennessee distillery, as saying the company outran its financial backing. Capital's Tennessee Spirits Company sourced its whiskeys from an unnamed Tennessee distillery, as we heard from Dave Shurick last November in episode 397 of WhiskeyCast. I have reached out to Capital Brands Management for more details, but have not received a response as of now. I'll have more on this story as it develops at WhiskeyCast.com. Let's talk about whiskeys now. What a concept. Delilah's is one of Chicago's top whiskey bars, and one of its best punk rock bars, too. Owner Mike Miller is celebrating the bar's 20th anniversary later this month, and he'll have a special whiskey to do it with. Mike and John Glazer of Compass Box worked together on a special blended scotch, and Compass Box Delilah's will make its debut at the anniversary party August 29th. I tracked John Glazer down on vacation in South Carolina for the details.
We've done blends for different accounts in the past. Usually what we do is, work up the batch and the account takes it all. But with this one, Mike and I worked this up together on his 20th anniversary, and we decided we wanted to share this with the world. So we're selling this through our distributors all around the world.
And tell me about the whiskey, because this is a 50-50 blend of malts and grains, right?
Yeah. If you've been to Delilah's, you know that it is a, as Mike likes to describe it, a punk rock whiskey bar. He sees it more as a bar that's about music, that has great whiskey and great beer. And it's all those things. It's a fantastic place. Very fun, open, democratic place, in the sense of being open to all sorts of people. There are people who are really into punk rock, and there are people who are really into whiskey, sitting next to each other at the bar and having a great time. And so it's for that kind of place, we wanted something that would be approachable to all sorts of people. One of the main ways whiskey is drunk there is a shot with a beer. And so this is a blend designed to work really well as a shot. It's round, it's got a lovely sweetness to it. It's got bourbon character to it because of the kinds of casks that were used to age the whiskeys. And it's got complexity and intensity, but it's also got this easy approachability that makes it perfect, enjoyed as a shot with a beer.
Which is completely different from all of your other whiskeys that are sipping whiskeys, right?
Well, to each his own is what I always say.
Nothing wrong with that, of course. But
enjoy the whiskeys any way they want. And certainly I've been known to drink shots of my whiskeys in the past, not other whiskeys. But this one, we wanted to make it a whiskey that would be right at home in Delilah's, in Delilah's Bar, which is, as I said, a fun place where people will typically drink their whiskeys with beer.
Now, you've got about, 6,000 bottles of this going out around the world, right?
Yeah, just over 6,000. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head now, but it'll be on the website. 6,000. It's going to go all over the world, wherever we sell our whiskeys, from France to Canada to Asia and, of course, all across the U.S.
And I assume Mike held back a bunch for a permanent display and sale at his place, right?
Yeah, Mike will have the largest cache of this of anyone else in the world. That's it today.
By the way, Compass Box has another anniversary bottling coming out in September, the 10th anniversary edition of Peat Monster. It's not quite an anniversary, but Ireland is celebrating the gathering this year. It's a year-long celebration of Irish culture and heritage worldwide, and the gathering now has its own whiskey. Teeling Whiskey Company released the Gathering Irish Single Malt this week at the Loops Airport shops in Dublin and Cork. It's an 11-year-old ex-bourbon cask single malt and will sell for €69.99, or about $93 U.S. Just 1,000 bottles are available. Also at the airports these days, the Balvenie is releasing a new triple cask series of 12, 16, and 25-year-old single malts, ranging in price from $75 for the 12-year-old to $450 or so for the 25. And Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport has the exclusive debut of the famous Grouse 40-year-old blended scotch through the end of September. Only 276 decanters will be available for the world. The price, £2,000 or a little more than $3,000. Maker's 46 is not new in North America. It's been out for 3 years now, but is making its debut in Australia this month. It'll be available in limited amounts for $79.99 Australian a bottle, and Bill Samuels Jr. is heading down to Australia for a series of tastings to launch Maker's 46. I am trying to get some details. Keep an eye on the calendar of events at whiskeycast.com for updates. On the auction front, 1964 was a very good year for Beaumont's, and this Wednesday was a very good day for 1964 Beaumont's at McTeers in Glasgow. Eight bottles from 1964 went on the block, including three Black Beaumores and five bottles from the 1964 series of Fino, Oloroso, and Bourbon cask bottlings. Hammer prices for the series ranged from £2,400 to £3,200. The high bid of the day, though, went to a Japanese single malt with a 50-year-old Yamazaki bottling that sold for £6,800, or about $10,200. The next McTeers auction is set for September 4th. And finally, here's another case where a decision a couple of decades ago is paying dividends now. Back in the 90s, Oban Distillery donated a cask of New Make Spirit to the local lifeboat service on the condition that they hang on to it until it was 18 years old. That cask was bottled recently. 240 bottles have already been sold through the Green Welly Shop in Tindrum, the Birchwood Filling Station in Oban, and through Mulberry Bank Auctions in Glasgow. So far, those sales have raised more than $60,000 for the Oban lifeboat, and there are still a few bottles left. One is being raffled off now, with tickets at £1 apiece. You'll find the details at WhiskeyCast.com, along with the latest whiskey news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Before we get to your voice, a quick update on the first round of Caskmasters. Voters around the world picked Cask C, the Manzanilla cask, as the one to be bottled. Next up, picking a name. Meanwhile, I picked a name at random from our registered community members at WhiskeyCast.com for July's gallery print drawing. Ed Piamo is this month's winner, and I'll be sending him one of the exhibition prints from the WhiskeyCast photo gallery. If you'd like to be in the running for the next drawing at the end of this month, all you have to do is register as a community member at WhiskeyCast.com. It's free, and we promise no spam. And if you'd like to see the prints in the gallery, just look in the mall. You'll find it in our virtual pub, along with the WhiskeyCast bookstore, powered by Amazon.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. Had several comments on last week's interview with Colin Ross of Ben Nevis, following his distillery's trophy win in the International Wine and Spirit Competition. Chris Mossop posted this note on our Facebook page. Fantastic episode, Mark. I really enjoyed the interview with Colin Ross, and congratulations should go to him and all the team at Ben Nevis. I've visited Ben Nevis twice in the last 10 years, the first time on my honeymoon. My then new wife and I visited a lot of distilleries in 2 weeks, and Ben Nevis was the first, and so far only, whiskey that she admitted she liked, so they must be doing something right. Well, that is high praise, Chris. And while I'll have my tasting notes for Buffalo Trace's Stagg Jr. Bourbon in a few minutes, I posted them earlier this week on the WhiskeyCast website. Stefan Brauner in Denmark posted this comment on our Facebook page. This is the Stagg for designated drivers and pregnant women, right? No. It's bottled at 67.2% ABV, almost as strong as last fall's George T. Stagg release, which was 71.4%. By the way, the strongest Stagg I've tasted is the 2007 edition, which came in at 72.4% ABV. Got word this week that the Owl Distillery in Belgium has now released a single malt at 76.1% ABV. I'm trying to get my hands on a sample. If you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com or on our Facebook page. You can also email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. And the comments of the week are brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at JohnnyWalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig, and August is shaping up to be a busy month. Caden Heads in Berlin, Germany, The Whiskey Shop in Auckland, New Zealand, and Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts, all have whiskey tastings on August 7th. Whiskey Fringe is this coming weekend in Edinburgh, Scotland, along with the famous Grouse Festival at Glenturret Distillery in Perthshire. And if you're going to be at the second Saturday single malt tasting at the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming on the 10th, there just might be a surprise in store. Our good friend Davin DeKergamo will host a Canadian whiskey tasting and book signing at the Waterman Grill in Providence, Rhode Island on August 13th. Musa in Aberdeen, Scotland has just become one of the bars stocking Scotch Malt Whiskey Society bottlings, and will have a special whiskey dinner on the 14th to celebrate. The Kensington Wine Market in Calgary will have a Cavaland vertical tasting on the 15th. And what may be one of the most remote whiskey festivals around is coming up in early September, Whiskey Live Reunion Island on September 7th and 8th. I didn't know this until now, but La Maison du Whisky has a whiskey shop on Reunion Island and is holding its first Whisky Live event at the Palm Hotel and Spa in Saint-Pierre. Now, where is Reunion Island? It's in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Madagascar. Geography lesson over. That's just one of the 311 different whiskey events on the calendar right now at whiskeycast.com, and you can search for events in your area or places where you'll be traveling or places you'd like to go to. You get the idea. The calendar is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, master distiller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
My family have been involved in the business. My father was the head distiller or master distiller of the old Middleton Distillery, which ceased operation in 1974. In respect of the handing on of the traditional practices, you could really say it was a family operation handing on the skills from one generation to another, particularly in my case. I actually lived on the site of the distillery, so it wasn't just merely the handing on of practices, it was indeed being very much aware from a very young age of the sounds, the aromas, the people who worked in the business. So it is, as it were, a full immersion in the whisky business.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whisky. Those in the know Redbreast.
This week on WhiskeyCast In Depth, we're heading down under. A couple of weeks ago, Matt Wooler of the Distant Thunder Whiskey Club posted a link on our Facebook page to an Australian TV story on Tasmanian whiskies. Of course, there were some familiar faces. Bill Lark of Lark Distillery and Mark Littler of Hellier's Road. You've heard from them before here on WhiskeyCast. Keith Batt of Nant Distillery is a relative newcomer, though. His family's farm distillery is 5 years old this year, and his whiskies are getting very good reviews. Tell me about the history. How did you? I know how Bill Lark and some of the other guys down there got started, but how did you wind up restoring the estate and then building a distillery?
Well, we bought the Nant estate in 2004, so we bought it really as a working farm, and it's very close to the fly fishing territory up there in the Highlands of Tasmania. And then after having the property for a couple of years, we saw what the other guys were doing about with the whiskey distilling, etc. And if people have ever seen Nant estate, you would swear that you were in Scotland, coming up through the borders into Scotland, and it's quite a picturesque location. And we have been growing barley there on Nant estate since 1821. And we have over 4 million litres of water every day go past the old water mill at Nant from a glacial lake. So it's quite a stunning location, and we've already got two of the key ingredients, I guess, for making whisky. So it wasn't hard to make the next step to actually turn it into a full working distillery.
Had you had any experience with distilling before then?
No, I hadn't. No, what I did is I employed one of the brewers from Bogues Brewery, which is a large Tasmanian brewer, and he came and worked with me for 3 years. He's still working there now, but the first 3 year contract was to really, you know, get the brewing side of things underway, and then we did some training on the distilling component, and just came up with a formula that we felt reflected the flavour profiles or the taste profiles that we wanted for our whisky. And it seems to be working out quite well. We're getting some very good reports now on our whisky. So we're pretty pleased with the way things have developed.
I know if you get a 95.5 from Jim Murray, that's a pretty good accomplishment in anybody's book, right?
Oh, it is. But also what we sent Jim Murray was a three-year-old American bourbon. We've just seen him a five-year-old, which in our opinion is fantastic. So, you know, like it's the early days, we're achieving great results. And I feel as if, you know, as we go forward, we'll actually, you know, be producing consistently very, very good quality single malt whiskey.
What is it about Tasmania that seems to make the whiskey from down there so good? Because while I have not had the chance to taste Nant, I've had the chance to taste some of the other Tasmanian whiskeys, and I've been impressed with all of them. What is it that you guys are doing in Tasmania that makes the whiskey so good?
Yeah, well, I had this exact same question from Whiskey Live down in Canberra just yesterday from the distillery manager at Glen Marais. He's the distiller there, and he was just, you know, making comment about the quality of the whiskey. And I just explained to him that, you know, there's a few sort of obvious variables in the process, but I think one of the fundamental things is the fact that we're using a very different style of barley to what they do in Scotland. So we're using more of a brewer's barley, which is used obviously in the large brewing operations in Tasmania, and that's the only barley that we really have access to. So I think that's one of the fundamental things. From an operational point of view, from a distilling point of view, once we've actually processed our wash, we actually don't put it through an underback. So we don't clarify our wash before we distill it. So it is quite cloudy, whereas in Scotland they actually use the underback and actually clarify it a lot more than what obviously we do. So therefore you end up with this sort of quite a nutty sort of hazelnut characteristic that comes through our whiskey. I think where we are up in the Highlands, we're 1,000 feet above sea level, which is pretty much as high or higher than the distilleries in Scotland. So we have a very, you know, very low atmospheric pressure up where we are. Water is different. I mean, our water in Tasmania, where we are at Nant, is quite hard water. It's coming down through sandstone. So, you know, it's quite a sweet water. So I think that's another influence. And probably the other thing is with our spirit still, we actually have an onion in the neck of our spirit still, which is unique to Australia. The other distilleries don't have that. So we're running our stills a lot slower. It's about 12 hours to run a 600 litre spirit still. So we run them a lot slower than in Scotland. Obviously, Glen Marais was telling me yesterday they're producing 19,000 litres a week, or we're producing 60,000 litres a year. So it's quite different. Yeah. Huge difference, yeah. But he was quite intrigued about, you know, how we break our barrels down. I was explaining to him that, you know, it takes us a month to break it one cask down to be bottled. He said, "What?" I said, "Yeah, you know, it's 1 month." I said, "We very slowly add water to the whiskey to break it down to 43% fat for bottling. We don't chill filter it, obviously, and we don't do it quickly. We just do it very slowly, and that allows the water to very gently marry with the whiskey, and you don't end up with the cloudiness at the end of the day. And I think you keep the oil viscosity intact, and one of the noted things about Tasmanian whiskey is that they're quite oily. There's a lot of viscosity in it."
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
The other thing I was impressed with was that you guys could have bought a mill just like the old classic Porteous mills we see up in the distilleries in Scotland, but you actually had this old water-powered classic-style mill on the farm that you restored, right?
Yeah, well, the old mill was built in the early 1820s by convict labour that were, you know, on the farm there at Nant. And when the early migrants came out from Wales, the Nicholas family, when they settled at Nant, they were actually millers in Wales. They called past Calais on the way through and picked up these magnificent French Burr millstones and came all the way up to Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, and came up into the Highlands as the first settler in the district. And they built this three-storey, you know, water-powered flour mill that's just, you know, remarkable. And it's the only commercially operating water-powered flour mill, certainly in Australia and probably in the Southern Hemisphere. And we used those stones. We actually found the stones down the paddock, down the field, and we brought them back and put them all back together again and got the mill working. And it hadn't worked for over, you know, 130 years. And it was like Sleeping Beauty coming to life. You know, I think, as I said the other day on Landline on the ABC, it's quite remarkable to feel the building come back to life again. And I can think of no better use than gristing barley to make your single malt whiskey.
How much of your barley are you actually growing at the farm?
We're growing about 38, 40 tonne. We're planting next month, so in August we plant again. And we need more barley than that. We can't grow enough of what we need. But the farmers around us grow the same variety of barley, which is a Gerda variety for the distillery, for the breweries, and we then can buy that malted barley directly from the big brew houses in Tasmania. We don't malt at Nant yet, but we have plans to be opening the malting plant next year in 2014.
What are you doing as far as expansion at the distillery? I know you're doing the whiskey bars around Australia, and we can talk about that in a second, but what are your plans besides expanding and doing malting at the distillery?
Yes, well, the malting plant is scheduled for construction commencement next year, so 2014. We're just expanding our brewing operations right now, so we're actually ordering another 3 washbacks for the distillery. And we're about to order 4 more stills to put into operation. So we'll have 6 stills in operation at Nant and be doing, you know, approximately about, probably up to about 100,000 litres a year is what we'll be sort of doing at Nant, with that being sort of really our optimum size. I mean, we don't really want to get much bigger than that, because we want to keep it very much that handcrafted, you know, feel to the process. So I think Edradour in Scotland, they do about 100,000 litres, so we'd be about the same size as the smallest distillery in Scotland then, with what we're planning.
And let's talk about the bars for a second, because you've opened at least a couple so far with plans for more Nant whiskey bars around Australia, right?
Yeah, we have got a whiskey bar in Salamanca in Hobart, which has been a tremendous success. And then on the back of that, we've opened up the bar in Brisbane at the Emporium Complex, which is just near the Fortitude Valley in Brisbane. And then we've got a second bar in Brisbane that's opening up next month. We have in Melbourne one that's going to be opening up early September, and we've got one in Canberra that's we're working on now, and also in Sydney. So we'll hopefully have about 8 or 9 whiskey bars in Australia, and then we're in London in October for the Craft Distillers Expo, hopefully, and we'll be looking for a location in London for our first international Nant whiskey bar.
And the whiskey bars not only feature your whiskies, but the other Tasmanian whiskies as well, too, right?
Oh, all the other whiskies from around the world. We have Emrut, to the Japanese whiskies, to the Scotch whiskies, to, that new whiskey in France, and the other Tasmanian distillers. So we have all the, you know, as many whiskies as we can get, you know, 200 or 300 is what we're trying to do. And that's really just to have this really interesting conversation with our customers about single malt whiskey, and why is one different to another, and we're comparing and contrasting and just having a lot of fun, you know, in the process. And it's not just about, you know, Nant whiskey, it's about single malt whiskey, and it's an environment for us to engage with our customers about single malt whiskey and Nant whiskey, what we're doing.
You mentioned the London bar that you're hoping to open. What about your export plans? When will we see Nant in most other parts of the world, especially the US, but also over in Europe as well?
We certainly get a lot of inquiry from Europe and as well as America. We have a number of barrel investors who actually are in America and Texas. We haven't had a lot of stock that we could really make it freely available for a big export market. And we're finding that the process of opening up our whiskey bars give us an opportunity to, you know, move into a particular country and then from there, you know, expand the story and tell our story from there, so that we can then be in restaurants and bars around, you know, Europe or America. We're going through the whole FDA process for America at the moment to get our approval to export in there, and we're working on a 750ml bottle. And we hope one day that we'll have, you know, some Nant whiskey bars in America that we can, you know, bring bring it directly there with our staff who work in the distillery, and they can tell the story to our customers over there.
So what did your family think when you came up with the idea to put a distillery on the farm?
Well, I can tell you what my accountant thought.
I'm not sure we can use that kind of language on the radio.
I know.
But go ahead.
I explained to my accountant that I wanted to get this whiskey collection as a tax deduction, and he said, "You've got to be crazy." I said, "No, it's a whiskey library. I want it as a tax deduction so that I can, you know, learn about single malt whiskey to open up a distillery." And I finally convinced him and turned him around. My family love it. My kids are only very young, so they love more the farm, I guess. And they've got their own 225 litre casks of whiskey, and they help with the bottling and the capping and whatnot after school and things like that. And my wife Margaret, she's very involved in the business, and you know, does a lot of the quality control and making sure that you know, the product is sent out to our customers, you know, in a very, you know, perfect way, really, which is what we're trying to do and be proud of, is that we're giving you something that we've created ourselves on our farm with our family, we want you to enjoy it as much as what we do, I guess. You know.
Can you see the kids taking over the business someday?
Yes. Well, I said to my son Henry, he's 10, and I said, "See that cask there, son? That 225 litre cask? Yes, Dad, I can see that cask." And I said to him, I said, "Well, when that cask is ready," I said, you can bottle that, and you're to take it down to the Salamanca markets in Hobart and sell that whiskey down there at the market stall." And I said, that money is able to put you through your university education and buy your car or whatever, to teach them about, you know, the customer focus and taking your product to your customer. And he's already at 10. He's already looking at the colour of the whiskey. He's not drinking, of course, but he's looking at the colour and saying, that's quite a good, you know, colour you've got there in the nose. It's not too bad, Dad." And he's 10 years old, but just sort of already giving an input into, and he questioned our marketing people, go, "Well, you know, exactly why are you doing that, marketing manager? You know, it's surely this would be a better idea." It's great. You know, it's really good to have the kids involved.
Smart kid you got there. You got him nosing yet?
Yeah, but they find it a bit hard being car strength, but they certainly can pick up a good colour at this stage. That's good.
Has this been as much fun as you thought it would be? It sounds like it is.
Oh, it's great. It's a lot of fun. We really enjoy it. You know, we're very passionate about it. And we've got a great team. You know, we've got 30 staff who work for Nant now, and they're an excellent group of people, and very committed, and they love what they're doing. And I guess it's infectious. And we go and talk to our customers then in the bars and tell them the Nant story and what we've done and how we've set the farm up and the distillery, etc. And you know, it's, people really appreciate the sort of the uniqueness of it, I guess, and the passion and commitment. But hey, I mean, if the whiskey wasn't tasting any good, then it'd be a hard sell. But the whiskey is coming up so well that we're able to really almost let it sell itself in a way. Well, I think what the important thing for all of us to recognise, and this is what we always say to our customers, is that we aren't the experts. Our customers are the experts. They know what they like, and our job is to really learn from them about how they like their whiskey, how they want to drink their whiskey, the environment that they want to sit to enjoy their whiskey. And it's not something where we're just telling them that, "Oh, you don't add water and you don't add this or do that." You know, we really just want to give people a great experience, a great Nant whiskey experience. That's what we're trying to do.
Some of that Nant experience will be available later this month. There's a whiskey dinner at the Nant Estate on August 17th. If you're interested, there are details at the Nant website, and you'll find a link at whiskeycast.com. That's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with a pleasant surprise. We heard from Beam's Fred Noe about the new Knob Creek Smoked Maple at the end of June, and I received a sample of it this week. Now, if you've been listening for any length of time, you know how I feel about flavored whiskeys. I'm not a big fan. But I tasted this one with an open mind. It's bottled at 45% ABV, and unlike most flavored whiskeys, the smoke and maple are very subtle on the nose, in very good balance with the classic Knob Creek notes of caramel, vanilla, and a bit of toasted oak. That balance continues on the palate with the bourbon's honey, vanilla, oak, and caramel balanced with mild smokiness and sweet maple syrup. If you like pancakes and sausage, you're probably going to be happy with this one. The finish is much shorter than the regular Knob Creek, at least on the first sip, but maple and smoke notes are very present when it's time for that second sip. This is one of the few flavored whiskeys I'd be willing to spend my own money on. I'm scoring Knob Creek Smoked Maple an 89. The sweet spot for a lot of Scotch whiskies is usually between 15 and 21 years old most of the time. After that, it's possible for the cask to start overpowering the whiskey's own flavors with some woodiness. I tasted the Maltman's new Glenturret 30-year-old bourbon cask bottling this week. Let me emphasize that that hadn't quite happened yet with this bottling, but it was clear that the wood was getting a little more aggressive. It's bottled at 46% ABV, and the nose is aromatic with vanilla and caramel balanced by cooked peaches and apples, a whiff of figs, and a slight smokiness. The taste is thick, spicy, and full-bodied with black pepper, chili powder, and cilantro heat that fades out slowly. But as it does, the oak starts to show subtly, along with vanilla and a fruity tartness, and hints of smoke and black licorice develop slowly and linger through the finish. Now, that finish is long, but the wood is there, along with the spices. I'm glad the Hart family bottled this one when they did, because a couple of more years and the wood could very easily have taken over. I'm scoring the Maltman's Glenturret 30-year-old bourbon cask an 80. And now for the Stag Junior. Believe me, this is definitely an end-of-the-evening dram. It's an uncut and unfiltered small-batch bourbon that's a younger brother of the George T. Stag bourbon. Batch number one was bottled at 67.2% ABV. The nose has notes of caramel, honey, and vanilla, but wasn't as spicy as one would expect. The taste is thick and intense, just like the Stag, with cinnamon and fresh ground black pepper notes that fade very slowly to reveal honey, caramel, vanilla, and a hint of pipe tobacco. The finish, though, is where Stag Jr. doesn't quite follow in its big brother's footsteps. It fades very quickly and leaves your mouth dry. I was hoping for a longer and smoother finish, and that takes away something from the overall experience. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not a bad bourbon at all. I just hoped for a bit more. I'm scoring batch number one of Stag Jr. an 84. You'll find these tasting notes on the WhiskeyCast website, along with my notes for more than 1,000 different whiskeys. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast virtual tastings and WhiskeyCast HD episodes, the calendar of events, the latest whiskey news, and a complete archive of past episodes, along with a whole lot more. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. You can follow me on Twitter at WhiskeyCast, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the Stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.